This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Broadband Over a Wireless Access World. We're about to speak to Jim Baller, who's an attorney in the telecommunications field. Welcome back to Utopia Media's Broadband Wireless Access World.
Thanks, Mark. Nice to be back.
Could you orient our new listeners about what your position is and the areas in which you're active in the field of telecommunications?
Sure. Our law firm, the Baller Herbst Law Group, represents the private sector or the public sector in communications matters across a wide range of different areas: telecommunications, broadband, cable, right-of-way management, etc. We are active on the federal level and in about 35 states. And one of the areas in which we're most active is in the community broadband area, and I understand that's what you'd like to talk about today.
Right. And so in a typical case, although maybe there are no typical cases, who do you represent and what kind of issues do you typically deal with?
Well, we've been doing this for the last decade, actually more than a decade, back before the days of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. We represent a number of national associations, including the American Public Power Association, the National Association of Telecommunications Officers and Advisors, state utility and municipal associations, and individual cities and public power utilities. We're involved in legislative matters, litigation. We've been involved in a large number of the leading public communications projects over the last decade, and wherever these issues lead, we follow them.
And the people who are on the other side in the cases that you pursue are usually either Who do those tend to be?
They tend to be the incumbent communications providers, the Bells or the large cable companies. Sometimes it is the representatives of state governments that have enacted barriers to entry. For example, in our case involving a Missouri barrier to entry, which went through the court system and ultimately was decided by the Supreme Court. The Attorney General of Missouri was the lead party on the other side. The Federal Communications Commission has sometimes been on the other side of our issues. But most often it is the incumbent communications providers that are the leading forces in the opposition to what we're trying to achieve.
And what you're, if you could sort of aggregate, what is it that you are usually trying to achieve in these cases?
We're trying to enable local governments to decide for themselves what they would like their communications futures to be. And that can consist of a lot of different options depending on what works for the community. In some cases, they may wish to allow the private sector to provide for the community's communications needs. In other cases, they may wish to form strategic partnerships with the private sector. In some cases, they may wish to create infrastructure that will support the provision of communication services by private sector retailers. In some cases, they may wish to provide retail services. In some cases, there may be some combination of those. Our position is that whatever a community wishes to do, as long as it informs itself through its regular processes and forms well-informed judgments, it should have the right to decide its own future for itself.
Now, based on obviously a vast amount of law and a vast amount of practice, what's the justification or the authorization or the authority of local communities to proceed in ways that they may choose through their own political processes to do?
that will depend on the status of state and local law in most instances. The federal laws at this point encourage provision of service by anyone, including local governments, so federal law does not form an impediment. At the state and local level, a state must authorize directly or indirectly a municipality or other local entity to provide service or engage in some other form of activity. And states do this in some instances by having statutes that or constitutions that authorize specific activities. Some states have home rule provisions that allow communities to decide for themselves. Some states allow all kinds of activities other than those prohibited and then have prohibitions or limitations. This is really something that one must view at the outset on a state-by-state basis and on an activity-by-activity basis. Part of the issue that we confront and part of the infrastructure, if you will, of the disputes that have emerged over the course of the last decade is that it is at the state level that the incumbents have been most active in attempting to obtain barriers or provisions that would either prevent or attach unworkable conditions to the way that local governments can provide communication services.
So
and that's what the fight has been about in most instances.
Okay, so in fact, in the same way that the states are the laboratories of democracy, they're also the laboratories of telecommunication reform.
I'm not sure that I would go that far, but yes, we've seen a great variety of different kinds of measures having different implications in the various states.
So the general rule then is that a city can do anything along the continuum of options that you listed, from regulating private companies to working with private companies to providing its own services to providing an infrastructure for private companies to do it at the discretion of the city or the county, absent absent any regulation or a statutory limitation from the state. Is that right?
It's partially correct. States fall into two rough categories, and within each category there is a great deal of variation.
Right.
We call states that have a rule that emerged in the 1800s, mid-1800s, first in Iowa, and then that rule spread in other places. This rule is called Dillon's Rule, after a judge on the Supreme Court of Iowa.
D-I-L-L-O-N?
That's correct. The rule is that a state or a municipality has only such powers as the state explicitly grants to it or that is implicit or an essential consequence of powers granted. And if there is no such explicit or implicit grant of authority, a municipality is deemed not to have the power in question. And so if there is silence, in Dillon's rule states, the determination must be made that a municipality does not have a power.
Okay.
In a home rule state, by contrast, a municipality is deemed to have all those powers that are not taken away by the state.
So essentially, in home rule states, the default is that the cities have the authority, and in a Dillon rule state, the default is that they don't.
Exactly.
And what's the distribution? How many Dillon's rule states are there, and how many home rule states are there?
You know, I can't tell you. I've seen many people attempt to make some effort to classify the states into Dillon's rule and home rule. And in my own experience, I can't agree with the classifications that I've seen from anyone. The reason for that is that there are a great many variations, both in the Dillon's rule and in home rule. And you can go from one state to the next and see similar language in the state statutes or constitution that are construed in different ways by the courts. You can have a state that has Dillon's rule for some sizes of cities or kinds of cities and home rule for other kinds of cities. And I don't think that one can really say that there are X number of home rule states and X number of Dillon rule states.
So it's pretty much a continuum then, ranging from...
It's a continuum, and you have to examine each set of circumstances very carefully.
Could you give us an example on either extreme of the continuum, what the most definitively Dillon rule states are and the most definitively home rule states are, and how that factors into some of the controversies now ongoing?
Well, sure, I can try that. California, for example, is a home rule state in many, if not most, instances, whereas Virginia is a Dillon's rule state and has a very strict Dillon's rule as it's construed. The complications come in when you realize that the statutes in Virginia read, in some cases, more broadly than other state statutes that have home rule. And you have home rule statutes that are expressly home rule, for example, in Wyoming, but the Supreme Court of Wyoming interprets those statutes as though they were Dillon's rule statutes.
Right. So as a general rule, are Western states more home rule oriented than Eastern states or Midwestern states?
I don't think that I can make that distinction. I just don't know.
Okay. Could we talk now a little bit more specifically about what's been going on at the state level that we've elucidated some of the legal
sure.
background for, and efforts, whether they're Dillon rule states or home rule states, by essentially incumbent carriers to limit the rights of municipalities to proceed with significant parts of the continuum of options that you laid out
sure.
as their possibilities.
All right, well, let's go back to the last time that we talked, which was, if I recall, sometime around December of 2004.
I think that's about right.
All right. At that time, there were approximately 14 states that had restrictions on municipal ability to provide communication services of various kinds. Now, the laws were different. Some applied only to some telecommunication services. Some had procedural restrictions. Some applied only to one method of delivery of services, such as retail but not wholesale. But altogether, there were approximately 14 states that had restrictions of one kind or another.
And had those restrictions been added recently, pretty much, as the technological capability to do this arose?
Not really.
Or had they been in existence for a while?
When the Telecommunications Act was first enacted in 1996,
right.
There was a burst of activity, and a half a dozen or so laws were enacted shortly after the Telecommunications Act came into effect.
Laws restricting municipal...
Restricting, that's correct. These were, in the first wave, in your face, you cannot provide telecommunication services laws.
Right.
Over a period of time, the incumbents changed their tactics, and instead of just enacting straightforward prohibitions, they began to introduce so-called level playing field or fair competition laws that conditionally allowed participation by municipalities, but set forth requirements that no municipality, or for that matter, no private party, if they had had to comply with those requirements, could have met. And then,
just very briefly, why did they change their strategy, do you think?
Well, it's easier to, you know, let me step back.
Right.
The first wave of restrictions just didn't make any sense whatsoever. We could go and show that the barrier, that a prohibition made no sense when much of the states had no broadband at all or very little broadband, and that restrictions on provision of telecommunications or broadband or cable services were counterproductive. The private sector was nowhere near to being able to serve whole states. They wouldn't get there anytime soon. We had localities that were very eager and moving forward on their own. And it was politically awkward, I believe, for even the incumbents to say with a straight face that it was appropriate to prevent communities from helping themselves when they had no intention of providing service in those communities anytime in the foreseeable future. And in fact, in a couple of states, Virginia was one, Tennessee was another, initial flat-out prohibitions were revised by the state legislature and relaxed in order to encourage municipalities to go forward with the provision of services under certain circumstances. After a while, as the incumbents began to see that simply saying no under no condition, under any conditions, was difficult to justify under circumstances of the kind that I've described, they found it easier to say, well, we welcome competition as long as it's on a level playing field, and here are our standards for determining whether a level playing field exists. Now, in our view, of course, an incumbent that has vast resources and benefits of incumbency starts from a very different position than an entrant, whether the entrant be a public or private sector provider. We have documented extensively what the advantages of incumbency are. Economists have written papers on such advantages and so on and so forth. So if one looks at the particular provisions that the incumbents advanced, they are not at all conducive of a level playing field. In fact, they're highly anti-competitive. But it's easier to justify a measure that is said to be a level playing field or fair competition measure than it is to justify a flat-out prohibition. But the impact of the two are exactly the same.
Okay, and then how did it go for the incumbents in pushing these so-called level playing field approaches?
Well, they got a few across in a number of states, and we're now talking about a 7, 8, 9 year period of time until 2004, and each year we would have battles in 2, 3, 4 states, and we're generally successful in resisting the enactment of new barriers. Every once in a while, a state would enact something, but by and large, we were successful in warding off new barriers to entry.
Now, as this was happening, what was the situation, if I could use the phrase, I guess, on the ground or in the ground, in terms of the deployment of broadband by incumbents or by municipalities who you had defended the right to provide it?
Well, incumbents were in limited areas expanding their services, and in areas where there were no barriers to entry or where the limitations were workable, municipalities moved forward. Dozens of them moved forward and created municipal communication systems, and they have largely been very successful.
And to what extent could you say that the aggressive approach of the municipalities influenced the behavior of the incumbents in terms of speeding up or changing or lowering the prices or otherwise acting competitively in order to meet that challenge?
Well, in places where there was a municipal system, we would very frequently see significantly lower prices, higher quality of service, greater choice. In fact, the Federal Communications Commission documented this year in and year out in its annual reports on the state of competition in the cable industry, for example. It would year in and year out confirm that the existence of competition would have these positive effects. And one could readily go to communities as close as next door and see rates 20, 30, 40% higher because of the absence of competition.
Was just the threat of municipal competition enough, or did it actually have to be in place to impact the incumbent's behavior?
Well, the impending decision by a municipality to go forward with the provision of a service or the development of a system frequently caused the incumbent to change the way it was doing business to accelerate a improvement of the system that would not have been done any time as nearly as quickly. We have many cases where the same incumbent provider would charge much higher rates but lower them in the or not raise them as frequently in areas where municipal competition existed or was threatened. So, yes, competition certainly works.
And this actually seems to be happening on a national level, because in my conversations with Diana Neff, the CIO of Philadelphia, about Wireless Philadelphia there, the price point that she seems to be talking about is somewhere between $10 and $15 per month per person for broadband access. And about the time that Philadelphia started to move ahead with its plans, SBC, an incumbent carrier here in California, announced a $15 a month for a limited time only DSL plan. And it seemed to me that someone at SBC was listening to what Diana Neff was saying in Philadelphia.
Well, I tend to think this is more of a market-by-market phenomenon than it is a national phenomenon, that it is more likely that SBC would be concerned with dealing with competition with the cable companies than it would be,
okay,
as a general matter, in dealing with municipalities, which occupy far fewer markets than the cable industry. But certainly when you view the individual markets, the behavior is very striking, not only the FCC, but also the General Accounting Office, or the Government Accountability Office, as it's called today, published reports studying this phenomenon as applied to private sector overbuilders whose interests are identical and whose activities are identical to those of many municipal providers, and the behaviors are exactly the same.
Could you say
by the incumbent.
Could you say something about the relationship between the incumbent telcos, the RBOCs, the Bell companies, and the cable companies in terms of competing with each other, as you've just mentioned, between DSL and cable modems, and their collaboration and cooperation against municipal systems?
Sure. What we have nationwide is a situation where many markets don't have broadband service at all. In some cases, they have broadband service by the cable company, in some by the phone company, but in most U.S. markets, there is what is referred to commonly as a duopoly, in which the cable company and the telephone company are each offering a broadband service of some kind, either cable modem service by the cable industry or DSL service, that's digital subscriber line, by the phone industry.
Because here in Los Angeles, Verizon versus Comcast seems, and SBC versus cable modem seems to be a common theme in television commercials.
Right. Now, the relationship between the cable companies and the phone companies is largely a cozy one, in the sense that the cable company and the phone company don't really push one another very hard. They're both offering single-digit broadband service. They aren't pushing themselves to increase significantly the bandwidth capacity or have dramatic drops in price, rather than teasers here and there, as like the SBC example that you're talking about. Their service quality for both industries, as reports, including frequent ones, just like those reported in the last couple of weeks, are that the cable industry and the telephone industry are at or near the bottom of the scales in national surveys of consumer satisfaction with services of various industries. And we refer to this situation as between the phone and cable companies as something of a co-opetition rather than true competition. If you look at antitrust cases or even findings of the Federal Communications Commission, duopolies, meaning where two providers control a market, are generally thought to be a bad thing. Duopolies in the context of mergers are not favored because they don't really produce robust competition. Monopoly, of course, for the many markets where there is only one provider, is even worse than duopoly.
Now, do these duopolies bleed over into becoming antitrust violations at any point?
Well, they might. The problem with that is that antitrust is such a complex, time-consuming, and expensive remedy that it takes years to amass a case of antitrust violation, and by then the harm has already been done. There's no way that a small competitor, be it public or private, and much of what I'm saying here, by the way, is not a matter of the incumbents versus the municipalities at all. It's the same conduct versus private sector entrants. And
we really don't have time to go into all of it, but the Brand X decision in the Supreme Court barring independent ISPs from cable lines, and the recent decision by the FCC putting telcos on an even playing field with that ruling, relieving the incumbent telcos of the responsibility to offer access to independent ISPs is what you're talking about in that direction as well, isn't it?
Yes, in part. I had in mind in the phone area competitive local exchange carriers,
right,
in the broadband internet service providers. There is also a whole class of providers called triple play overbuilders. There used to be many of those. For the most part, they're gone now, and we have only a handful of them left. And the incumbents' tactics vis-a-vis these competitors are pretty much the same as their tactics vis-a-vis municipalities.
So say just a little bit more about what the triple play is and what an overbuilder is, and so what, what triple play overbuilders are.
Okay. The triple play is voice, video, and data. In other words, in the past, systems were built in order to support telephone service, cable television, and sometimes internet. Now, with the modern-day facilities and upgrades to the copper plant that the phone companies operate, the coaxial hybrid fiber and cable that the cable industry uses, and fiber and even wireless, it is possible to provide all three services and sell the services sometimes in combinations. The triple play is a common term used to describe offering all three services over the same facilities.
And this in fact, is a implementation of what used to be popularly called convergence, digital convergence, isn't it?
Correct. That's okay. Correct. And when I said that there was a whole class of private sector triple play providers, what I meant to say was that it beginning in the late 90s, a couple dozen or so private sector providers found that if they built facilities capable of supporting telephone, cable, and broadband service, the economics of overbuilding were very attractive to them.
Overbuilding means building this in a locale that already has one or both of these DSL or cable modem services.
Yes, I'm sorry for using insider terms,
but
they come second nature to me.
Right, no, it's fine to use them. We just want to explain them to people.
Right, that's correct. And so what I'm saying is that municipalities as well, those at least that are interested in providing retail service, also can use facilities for all three services if those municipalities operate their own electric utilities. For example, the economics are even more attractive for them because they can use their same infrastructure to support their utility applications and that way make the provision of a whole range of services very efficient and very economically attractive
both for
their
own
communities that own them.
Both for their own internal use as utilities and for providing a broadband and or a triple play to the residents.
Correct. And let me just clarify that for someone who might not understand that an electric utility is a massive user of communication services to operate the infrastructure of an electric system, to do remote meter reading, to manage its substations, to find electric power in real time at various places across the country. And they would have those needs even if they were not interested in providing communication services to the public or making their facilities available to partners or others who might want to lease access to it. But as it happens, if you're going to build a system or you're going to upgrade a system that can support these very sophisticated communications needs of an electric utility, for just a little amount of additional cost, you can also lay in enough excess capacity to be able to use those resources, those assets, to support the provision of cable television, telephone service, broadband service, either when provided by the municipal utility or any electric utility themselves or in partnerships with private sector providers or simply by leasing the infrastructure to anyone who wants to use it.
And, in fact, that would involve what broadband over power line or BPL or perhaps something in deference to amateur radio operators who find that sometimes inconveniences them. The low-power power line LV that Motorola is developing now based on Canopy, which is a wireless home plug amalgam that that uses the power lines for the last 100 feet or so.
Well, it's important to distinguish between using power lines as the medium of communications transport,
right,
and also building fiber, which communications, which are separate cables.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Not the same as the electric power cable.
Okay, I see what you're saying. In other words, the utilities can put in their own fiber to do their own internal operations, but they can also then sort of overbuild that a little bit and use that to offer services to businesses and individuals.
Correct. That's correct. And more recently, technology has now gotten to the point where electric utilities can also use the power lines as a way of getting communication services to end users. Today's technologies are such that a fiber system would have vastly more bandwidth capacity than using the power lines would give an electric utility, but the capacity of the power lines and the electronics that use them is improving steadily.
So, in fact, on the technical side, utilities could use either BPL over the power lines, fiber optic alongside or to complement the power lines, or something like Canopy and HomePlug to do a wireless wireline combination.
Right. Or that's right. And, in fact, every one of those permutations is out there in the field.
Or,
there are municipalities that have combinations of fiber and wireless. Some are deploying broadband over power lines that uses wireless in some technologies that are being used. So,
or in fact, they could do the wireless sort of a parallel to the power lines, and then use home plug from the power grid into the home.
Correct.
Okay. There's obviously a lot more on the technical side and the
right.
political side and the litigation side here that we can talk about, but we both have to get on to some other things. So,
mm-hmm.
With your permission, maybe we can just sort of wrap up now and see when we can get back together again sometime soon and move on to talking about what the political situation is in the states, and we haven't talked at all about what's going on in Washington with bills from Representative Sessions and Senators Lautenberg and McCain and Senator Ensign, a whole lot of things going on there that I'd also like to talk about. But
okay.
Why don't you just sort of wrap up with just a little bit about where things have stood, and we can maybe make a cliffhanger for our listeners, what the trend lines have been in terms of states moving to limit municipal broadband, and how that's may have led to some sort of desire on the part of some players to move to the federal level.
Okay, that's a good idea. And let me circle back to where we were at the end of 2004. There were 14 states that had some restrictions. In 2005, proposed new restrictions in, as it happens, 14 states. There was some overlap in some states. There already were restrictions, and the incumbent sought additional ones on top of it. We are now through about 12 of the 14 states, and so far only one has enacted significant new barriers to entry.
That would be Nebraska.
That would be Nebraska. And elsewhere, we've either been able to stop the process entirely or enter into compromises that promised to work for all sides. The reason we've had that kind of success has been that marvelous coalition of forces has come together, including national associations that support local government initiatives, consumer groups, grassroots organizations, and some of the large high-tech companies and their organizations have all come together to say that state barriers are not good for the communities involved. They are not good for the private sector that would benefit from broader affordable access to high bandwidth broadband, and they're not good for America as a whole, as America has been steadily declining in global status in broadband deployment, access to high bandwidth capacity, and cost per unit of bandwidth. And so as more and more information has come to the attention of state legislators and the public at large and the media, more and more folks have said these barriers are not a good idea. And so we've done very well at the states, probably a lot better than the incumbents may have anticipated, and now action has shifted over to the federal government as well. We've seen three bills introduced, two that would be anti-municipal and one that would be very favorable to municipalities. We hope that we build similar strength at the federal level as we appear to be doing at the state level. And when we have more time, we can develop those themes in greater detail.
That's exactly what we'll do. So let me thank you very much for bringing us up to this point. And as soon as we can schedule it, we'll get together again and talk about what's going on in Washington within the context that you've very clearly laid out for us here today on Utopia Media's Broadband Wireless Access World. Thanks very much.
All right, and thank you, Mark, and your listeners.
Okay, bye. Good. Bye.